All right, so if you haven't already, go ahead and open up there to the book of Exodus, which is where we'll be. And while you're doing that, there's something I wanted to show you. So back in May, there was a zoo in China that started getting a lot of attention over their panda exhibit. I think we have a clip of that panda exhibit. Pretty cute, but people were pretty upset, actually. Maybe you can figure out why. Yeah, those aren't pandas. Those are dogs whose hair was dyed to look like pandas. I think Chow Chows is the actual breed of dog. So people were upset because, you know, clearly those were not pandas as advertised. But this was not the first time something like this has happened, actually. A little over a year ago, there was a photo that started circulating from another zoo in China. And as people looked at this photo, they started to think, that's not a bear. That's a person in a bear costume. I think we can zoom in a little. You can see it's a little baggy in the back, and people thought it was maybe wearing Birkenstocks instead of having actual bear feet. Now, the zoo did come forward in this case. They showed a video. They said, no, this is a real bear. I'm sure if you go and watch it, you'll be convinced as well. But these panda dogs are pretty fascinating to me because you look at these, and I was just thinking, I mean, the zoo had to know, right? Like, it's not going to fool people. Once you're there in person, you're going to recognize that's a dog and not a panda bear. It would only ever be enough to get people in the doors. Once you're there, people are going to see these dogs in person with their own eyes and know that they are frauds. But, you know, it isn't always easy to know a fraud from the real deal. In 1925, in Paris, Paris, France, not our Paris, it was a bad time for the Eiffel Tower. It was falling into disrepair, and maintaining it and repainting it was very expensive. So public sentiment was kind of turning against the Eiffel Tower, and newspaper articles were being written concluding it should be done away with. Time to get rid of the Eiffel Tower. So this guy, Victor Lustig, he called together a group of scrap metal dealers to a secret meeting at a hotel. And he explained there that as the minister of posts and telegraphs, he had been charged with finding a buyer to purchase the Eiffel Tower for scrap metal. And because this was kind of a sensitive matter, and there were a lot of feelings about the Eiffel Tower, it wasn't going to be handled publicly. They were going to iron out the deals in secret and then instead announce what was happening. So each of the scrap dealers were asked to submit a bid to purchase the Eiffel Tower. Now, one of them, a guy named André Poisson, I can't speak French, we'll go with that. He was very interested in making the purchase. And so it was a chance for him, you know, to kind of rise up in the inner circles of Paris's business community. But upon meeting privately with Victor Lustig, the minister of Posts and Telegraphs, he made a discovery. Lustig was a corrupt official. He wanted to live a more lavish lifestyle than his government job offered him. And with the right bribe, the Eiffel Tower could belong to André. So André, he pulled his resources together, and he paid Victor Lustig 70,000 francs, which today equates to about 1.5 million U.S. dollars. And then Victor Lustig vanished. He disappeared. You see, as it turns out, the Eiffel Tower was not for sale. And Victor Lustig did not work for the government. He was just a con man who is now 70,000 francs richer. And what's really amazing about the story is that Lustig, who fled to Austria after that, he was sure his crime would never be reported. Why? Well, he thought André would be too embarrassed to admit that he tried to buy the Eiffel Tower from a con man. And you know what? He was right. It was never reported to the French police. In fact, Victor Lustig got so confident, he went back to Paris. And guess what? He sold the Eiffel Tower again to a different buyer, okay? However, this time at the very last second, the scam was sniffed out by police, and Victor Lustig, he ended up fleeing to the U.S. to avoid arrest. And history is full of people like this, just like Victor Lustig, cons and frauds. from Mary Baker, who pretended to be a princess from a fictional island so that investors would back her, to Charles Ponzi, who the Ponzi scheme is named after, just goes to show whether you're looking to climb the ranks of the Paris social elite or you just want to see some pandas, we're not always good at knowing who someone really is. Sometimes the truth of someone's identity eludes us. And this year, as I've shared on Sunday mornings, we've explored this idea of identity in the book of Exodus. And right off the bat in Exodus, we're introduced to the three major players in this account: the Israelites, Pharaoh, and Moses. And each of them, they wrestle with a core identity issue. They struggle to have a proper understanding of who they are. We've looked at the Israelites, their struggle. It was with looking back and longing for the slavery of Egypt rather than trusting God with their future. And we saw how God mercifully helped them to see that he was with them in the past, he's with them in the present, and he will continue to be with them in the future. He was never absent, he never will be absent, so they can continue to put their trust in him. Last time I shared, we encountered Pharaoh, perhaps the most powerful human alive in his day. Incredibly evil, he had built his identity and his empire on the total control he wielded over the world. But when he set himself against the God of all things, he discovered his control was just an illusion. And the tragedy of Pharaoh's story is that he was so focused on being in control that he lost the opportunity to know the one who's actually in control. And today, we come to the hero of the story, Moses. Now listen, you don't have to grow up going to Bible class or attending VBS to hear about Moses. I mean, his story really is incredible. The baby Israelite who grows up as a prince in the palaces of Egypt, he met God at the burning bush. He turned a stick into a snake. He parted the Red Sea, received the Ten Commandments. He wrote the first five books of the Bible. Numbers 12:3 even says this: "Now Moses was a very humble man, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth." The most humble man on earth. Now, of course, the book of Numbers, also one of those first five books that Moses himself was primary author on, so do what you will with him writing about himself that he was the most humble man on earth. Either way, clearly Moses' life is an incredible highlight reel. It's just hit after hit. But before we dig deeper into what Scripture reveals to us about Moses' sense of identity, there's one other story I want us to take a look at. It's the story of the fire festival. Now, maybe you've heard about the fire festival, maybe not. Planned back in April 2017, it was like the A-list event of the year. It was billed as a transformative weekend on a private island in the Bahamas. It was going to be an immersive music festival on the boundaries of the impossible. I have no idea what that means. Fire was set to be an experience and a festival and a quest to push beyond those boundaries, all right? I mean, what could go wrong? Fire is going to have the best of everything the world has to offer: food, music, accommodations. You could even have your own private yacht for 2 weeks. It was promoted by big celebrities like Kendall Jenner and Ja Rule. He was one of the organizers. As you can expect, this thing was not cheap to attend. A day pass would range anywhere from $500 to $1,500 just for the day. Now, there were VIP packages with luxury tents and other benefits, and they went from $12,000 to $250,000 for the 2 weeks. Now, that $250,000 price did include the private yacht. People got excited, all right? It was becoming a big deal. This was a chance to live for a few days like movie celebrities or influencers. I mean, it was a chance to live a life you've never otherwise experienced for 2 whole weeks. So, the day arrives. It's April 28th. You have about 5,000 people going to this thing, and they're traveling from Miami to Fire Cay Island. Now, turns out there really is no Fire Cay Island. Instead, it was taking place on an island called Great Eczema, which is not exactly the private island that was advertised. There's a population of about 7,000 people there. Okay, and out of the 5,000 people going from Miami to this island, only 500 people ever make it. All right, everyone else's flights end up getting canceled, and you'll see why. But as they get there, these first 500 arrive. A school bus picks them up and drives them to a lot full of FEMA tents. Okay? These are disaster relief tents. And not only is this a little less maybe than what was advertised, but there's no indication which tent belongs to who. You know, is this a $500 tick, like a $500 ticket tent, or is this a $12,000 tent? There's no way to tell. A free-for-all ensues, people just grabbing whatever tent they can find. Now, it had taken them about 5 hours to travel from Miami to this island, and during that time, they've had no access to food. So people were understandably hungry. Finally, the VIP privately catered food arrives. This is a legitimate picture of the food from the event. You have here some lettuce and a cheese sandwich, all right? I hope you didn't get the $12,000 ticket, right? The luggage showed up on a shipping container at night. There's no lights and there's no labels. People are getting their stuff stolen. There's no way to find your luggage. And if you did, at least you could utilize the security lockers Fire provided. If you remember to bring your own lock to put on the lockers, otherwise it's just a little door. A few hours in, most of the staff quit. Not that you could tell, because there were no staff uniforms, there were no walkie-talkies. The staff, like, nobody knew who was staff and who wasn't. There was no way for them to communicate or find out what was gone anyway. I mean, it was an abysmal start to this thing. But at this point, if you'd made it to the island, the best you could do is make the most of it and enjoy the music. Yeah, every musical act canceled. Every single one. No one showed up. There was no music. And since, even though you only had 500 out of the 5,000 registered people make it to the island, there still aren't enough beds to go around, there's a good chance your bed's been stolen, you haven't had anything to eat, and there's no music to listen to. The final blow came when the Bahamas Board of Tourism stepped in and officially canceled the event, forcing anyone still left to head home. And people did make it home after they got locked in the airport for hours. Some people passed out. A person had to be hospitalized while waiting on their flight home. Just a total disaster, right? And if you're wondering who's responsible for all this, the man at the top was this guy named Billy McFarlane. And naturally, a lawsuit was filed and another. Then he was arrested by the FBI for wire fraud. And all these stories started coming out from behind the scenes, how there was never really enough money to put this event on. And they tried to convince Billy to postpone for a year. Just a total train wreck. There's this one interesting thing. Before McFarlane's sentencing, his lawyer asked the judge to lessen his sentence. And he said McFarlane had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder and that he had delusional beliefs of having special and unique talents that will lead to fame and fortune. I think both Hulu and Netflix maybe have whole documentaries about this thing. I haven't watched them. I'm not recommending them. But man, it's clear that this was a huge public failure. In fact, the failure is worse because of how high the expectations were. It's that same idea as the old saying, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. The greater the expectations, the more deeply we feel the failure. And that's the combination I want us to think about. The combination of high expectations followed by obvious failure. Because I think that is what Moses shares with the Fire Festival. And that's where I want us to spend our time this morning, considering the failures of Moses. It's interesting to note, it seems like the biblical text sets us up to be disappointed by Moses. I mean, he enters the scene like the chosen one in a movie. There's an evil, powerful villain, Pharaoh, committing genocide against the Israelite people. Moses is born, and the circumstances, they work out perfectly. In a time when he should be killed, his mother takes a risk. She risks her own life. She sends him down the river toward the Pharaoh's daughter. And the princess takes pity on Moses. She ends up hiring Moses' own mother to nurse him. Moses not only lives, his mother gets paid to take care of him while he's an infant. And he ends up in the palace, an actual prince. And you gotta just pause and realize how perfect this all is. You have a terrible villain, Pharaoh, trying to stamp out the children and spirit of the Israelites. And despite his best efforts, one of those babies that he's trying to destroy survives. Not only survives, but grows up in the palace as a prince. He's taught military tactics, languages used for diplomacy, how to fight. Pharaoh is training up the hero who will destroy him. He doesn't even know it. And God's arranged it all, has prepared the perfect hero to save his people. Just look at how the Bible describes him, this moment in chapter 2, verse 11. This is the moment it all leads up to. One day, when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people. He looked on their burdens. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. You feel the tension in that moment, right? The suspense. This is the moment when it's all going to go down. You can imagine how it would go if Hollywood was directing it, right? The Egyptian, he brings his fist down towards the Hebrew slave, but someone catches it. The Hebrew looks up. It's the prince. It's the prince has caught the blow. This fight scene ensues. Moses barely manages to help the Hebrew slave escape. They're forced to go into hiding among the Israelites there in Egypt. And it's among them Moses learns more about his people. He becomes the leader of a rebellion against the Egyptian government. His talents and his training are the key to their victories. And ultimately, the Hebrew rebels rise up. They take down Pharaoh and his cruel forces, and peace spreads across the land of Egypt. I mean, you can imagine that, right? Somebody could write that. And maybe looking at the setup, that's what you expect. That's not how it goes. It's not how it goes. Instead, we read in verse 12, he looked this way and that, seeing no one. He struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. In secret, Moses takes vengeance on this man. And the next day, after murdering the Egyptian, he goes out. He sees two of his own people fighting, knowing he's the one, right? The chosen one, the destined hero. Moses goes up to solve the problem, telling them to stop. He says, why are you fighting each other? And the man answers in verse 14, who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? And as soon as it starts, it's all over. Moses is not seen as a hero. He's viewed as a murderer. The people don't believe in him, right? They're not looking to rally behind him. In fact, there's incredible irony here as the man asks him, who made you a prince? Because who made Moses a prince? Who put him in the perfect place? Who saved his life? God gave him the training to rescue the Israelite people. God made him a prince. He's the one who made him a prince. But now, because of what Moses has done, it's all thrown away. He's failed. He's cast as the hero of the story, but in a moment of anger and impulse, he ruins it. Instead of leading his people out of slavery, he runs away into the desert. He disappears out of Egypt and out of his people's memory. And this is not Moses' only failure. It's really the beginning of many. In Exodus 3, after an entire season of life has passed, you know, Moses has become a different person. He left his life in Egypt behind, new family, new people. He re-encounters God at the burning bush. God has not forgotten the Israelites or Moses. Here's a second chance. And in what should be this moment of redemption where Moses is called to something great, he refuses. He's terrified. He exhausts his list of what ifs. He begs for someone else to go. Moses squirms. You're left looking at it and asking, is this really the hero who God is going to use? Even after he accepts the task on his way back to Egypt, another huge issue arises towards the end of chapter 4. Moses is about to die. We're told God sets himself against Moses here, and it's because Moses has failed to circumcise his own son. It's something of a confusing passage, but remember back in Genesis 17 that circumcision is the sign of the covenant between God and Abraham and his descendants. It's a sign of the promise that God would be with them, that they would be his people, that God would bring blessing to the world through them. And Moses has not practiced the sign of that covenant. What happened here? What went wrong? Maybe Moses, on fleeing from Egypt, he wanted to disconnect from God's covenant, and so he intentionally neglected circumcising his son. Maybe he isn't sure how the future will play out, so he has hesitated. What we can be fairly certain of, however, Moses didn't just forget about this practice, because his wife, Zipporah, who herself is not an Israelite, she understands the problem. She recognizes the issue. It's made clear when Moses is about to die, she intervenes and she circumcises their son, saving Moses' life. Now, admittedly, these moments of failure, they come before the Exodus, before God rescues his people miraculously out of Egypt. And you might think, after seeing the plagues, right, the fiery pillar, the parting of the Red Sea, being part of all those things, that Moses matures, his trust in God grows, he leaves his mistakes behind. And there's some truth in that. But what may be Moses' largest failure actually comes much later. It's in the book of Numbers, actually. Numbers 20. During the 40 years when the Israelites, because they doubted God's power and instead feared the power of the armies in Canaan, so they're wandering the wilderness for these 40 years, and they're running out of water, the people are growing desperate. And we'll pick up in verse 6 of Numbers 20. It says, Moses and Aaron left the people. They went to the entrance of the meeting tent. There they bowed face down, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. The Lord said to Moses, take your walking stick, and you and your brother Aaron should gather the people. Speak to that rock in front of them so that its water will flow from it. When you bring the water out from that rock, give it to the people and their animals. So Moses took the stick from in front of the Lord, as he had said. Moses and Aaron gathered the people in front of the rock, and Moses said, now listen to me, you who turn against God. Do you want us to bring water out of this rock? Then Moses lifted his hand, and he hit the rock twice with his stick. Water began pouring out, and the people and their animals drank it. I don't know if it seems like a big deal when we read it, but it's a big deal. And I don't know what it points to within Moses, but it's worth noting his words before his disobedience. He says, do you want us to bring water out of this rock? I don't know. Is Moses claiming that he's the one responsible for the miracle? Does he just want to remind them of everything he's done for them? The text does tell us it has to do with two things. It has to do with trust in God and a failure to honor God. Maybe the failure to honor God comes as a result of seeking to honor himself. It's, who can say, but regardless, God says this in the next verse, because you did not believe me, Moses, and because you did not honor me, as holy before the people, you will not lead them into the land I will give them. This consequence is heavy. Moses' life work was to lead the people out of Egypt and into Canaan, and now he's never going to step foot there. Another failure, and this one with a huge, a painful cost. So there are some of Moses' failures. And what are we to do with them? You know, why are they here? Why are they recorded? When you stack these up, I'm not sure how it makes you feel about him. Maybe it's disappointing. I think something in all of us appreciates a hero who always does the right thing, and no matter the cost. It's hard to watch the people we admire and look up to falter and fail. Maybe you think that, you know, in the light of everything Moses gets right, these are kind of small potatoes. He does a lot of good things. Maybe we should, in an act of charity, just overlook his mistakes. And maybe most of us just accept that Moses, like us, was human. He was imperfect. He was flawed. He's made in God's image. He's capable of great acts of love, beauty, and self-sacrifice, but he's also sinful and selfish, capable of evil and pain, also just like us. I know I'm thankful that the Bible doesn't present unrealistic, flawless heroes, but instead it gives us the flawed people of real history that God uses in spite of their faults. You know, Abraham lied about his wife's identity twice. David uses his power as king to commit adultery and murder Bathsheba's husband. Peter denies Jesus. Paul got into it so bad with Barnabas, they parted ways. You know, the Bible is full of the reality of imperfect people who fail. But instead of us trying to decide what to do with Moses' failure, I instead like to look at what Moses did with his failure. We don't know exactly how Moses responded to each recorded failure or any of the unrecorded ones, but there is one thing we know about Moses, something that Scripture makes very clear about him. is that Moses was the most humble person on the planet. Now, I know earlier I kind of poked some fun at this verse because, you know, if Moses wrote this, it does seem an odd thing to write about yourself if you're the most humble person on the planet. But, you know, there are clearly passages in the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, that were added by someone other than Moses. Deuteronomy, for example, has an account of Moses' own death at the end. That would have been an odd thing for him to write about, right? So it's certainly possible that someone else, inspired by the Holy Spirit, added important true details and events for God's people to read about after Moses had recorded the majority of it and died. Or maybe Moses did write this himself. You know, either way, I don't really doubt that Moses was the most humble person alive at the time. Because when you fail, you really only have two choices. You can dig in, and you can put up walls, and you can deny your failure, figure out who else's fault it is, hold on to your pride, or you can recognize you're not perfect, and you learn and you grow in humility. And that seems to be the story of Moses. Someone who likely did grow up with a certain sense of pride, a sense of self-importance, a belief perhaps not so different from our Fyre Festival friend who believed so deeply in his uniqueness and ability that it led to disaster and failure. But that's not where Moses stayed. You know that thing we do? I hope it's not just me, where we replay a moment from our past and we think about what we wish we had done differently. We go back. You know, like when you're leaving a store or a restaurant and the greeter says, thanks, come again. You say, you too. And you're like, oh, why did I say that? Although more likely we have some pretty serious moments that we replay and wish we'd chosen differently about. Moments where we hurt someone with something we said, or a moment where we should have spoken up and we didn't. You have to know Moses had those moments, right? Years spent alone in a field as a shepherd in Midian. He's sitting at night by the fire, replaying that day in his mind, wishing he'd done it differently, knowing he messed up. Often the battle over someone's soul, at least immediate, is depicted as like an angel on one shoulder and a demon on the other, right? Both trying to overcome the other and influence the person. But I think a more accurate understanding of the battle for our souls is the battle between our pride and our humility. You know, do you think you know best? Whose ways are higher, yours or God's? Do you need him or are you self-sufficient? Are your mistakes someone else's fault or are you responsible for your sin and in desperate need of a savior? C.S. Lewis said this about pride. The vice I'm talking of is pride or self-conceit. The virtue opposite to it in Christian morals is called humility. According to Christian teachers, the essential vice, the utmost evil, is pride. Unchastity, anger, greed, drunkenness, and all that are mere flea bites in comparison. It was through pride that the devil became the devil. Pride leads to every other vice. It is the complete anti-God state of mind. And Jesus said this in Luke 14:11, for all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. You know, that's not advice. That's not a quick tip. That is a promise about reality. That is how the world, how life works. And the promise is this: humility is inevitable. You can humble yourself and learn from your failures, admit your mistakes, acknowledge you're imperfect. You can humble yourself or you will be humbled. Because one day we will stand before God and any illusions of pride, of self-sufficiency will vanish. We asked today, or I asked, what are we to do with Moses' failures? And I want to close by asking another question. What do we do with our failures? What do we do with our failures? Or maybe a better question to ask, will we humble ourselves. We don't live in a culture that values humility much. If you doubt that, here comes an election year. Let's watch and let's see, how often the virtue of humility is emphasized as a necessary quality for our leaders. But it is a necessary quality for followers of Jesus. Colossians 3:12 tells us to clothe ourselves with humility. It's something we cover ourselves in that other people can experience and see. We're called to be a church, a family where we love each other with humility, where we are charitable with one another. We give each other the benefit of the doubt. We expect the best, not the worst. Let's encourage and value humility among our leaders here. Pray for the leaders here to be able to admit mistakes and to lead humbly. Let's flood our city with humility. Let's respond to conflict at work or school or on our team or in our relationships, not with what will best get me what I want, but what will best reflect a humble walk with Jesus. As Paul writes in Philippians 2, in humility, value others above yourself, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. I do think there's a tricky aspect to talking about humility, because in recognizing our faults and our failures and our weaknesses, I don't want to ever devalue anyone, right? I imagine that's one reason C.S. Lewis is so famous for his quote about humility, where he said, humility is not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less, right? And I think one of the things that's so beautiful about our faith is that it makes sense of both the highs and the lows of the human experience. The fact that we are sinful, it makes sense of our selfishness and our evil, our capacity, even our inclination to do harm to others. But because we are made in God's image and he loves us in a way that's impossible to understand, and because his grace abounds, we're also capable of great beauty and acts of self-sacrifice. And every single individual person matters and has immeasurable value. And it's those two things, right? God's love for us and our great value to him and our evil and sinfulness that were fully on display when Jesus became like us to die for us, to rescue us from our failures. And so humility is not a devaluing of ourselves. It's instead a recognition that we need him and he loves us so much. He held nothing back to rescue us. He wants you to be with him. He wants you to be with him forever in his presence. It reminds me of an incredible scene in Exodus 33. In Exodus 33, God's glory passes by Moses. It seems, as you read the passage, it seems to happen in some sort of physical way Moses experiences. In fact, God covers Moses up with his hand until God's face has passed by so that Moses doesn't die from the experience. We're also told in verse 11, Moses would speak with God as one speaks with a friend. Moses was there. He was in God's presence. And I can only imagine that someone who experienced such a close encounter with God, who saw him in his glory, who talked with him as a friend, someone would probably lose any pretense of pride or self-importance if you had an experience like that. If you had an experience like that, you would probably end up the most humble person on the planet. Let's pray that we grow in humility as we spend more time with Jesus. Let's stand together. Let's worship.